Okay, here we go.
All right.
Goodbye. Okay, let's get this back.
Hi, this is Debbie Mayer in Hudson, and you're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 on your radio dial or streaming 24/7 at WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Neva Wartell of Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. I'm Philip Grant. Yancey Roy in Newsday reports that New York lawmakers passed more police reforms on June 10. They have now approved 10 bills in their 3 days back in Albany after 3 weeks of protest around the country in the wake of the murder of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police. Legislators voted June 10th to make permanent a special prosecutor's office investigating cases in which a person dies in an encounter with law enforcement. Governor Andrew Cuomo had created the prosecutor in the state attorney general's office by executive order in 2015, but it now becomes permanent when Cuomo signs the bill. Republicans say the office takes away authority from locally elected prosecutors, while Democrats counter that those local prosecutors often are chummy with local police. Lawmakers also voted to create, mostly on party lines, the, and I quote, Law Enforcement Misconduct Investigative Office, end quote, also within the Attorney General's office. Earlier in the week, they voted to make police disciplinary records subject to disclosure. Law chokeholds establish a right to record police activity and ordered body cameras for state police. Cuomo said he will sign the bills. Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart Cousins said, and I quote, make no mistake, we know that what we did is not a cure. We know it's the first step. It acknowledges that laws alone are important, but they can't fix racism in America. But it begins to root out injustice and to bring justice to our justice system. It is a step and it is a path to equality, end quote. Other localities are passing their own police reforms. On June 10th, the Times Union reports Schenectady Mayor Gary McCarthy signed an executive order banning police chokeholds and creating several other reforms a day before a scheduled demonstration outside City Hall. There was also a protest in Kingston June 10th, and another planned for Socrates June 11th, and two other protests in Chatham and West Point scheduled for June 13th. Sarah Tapton is reporting for Columbia Green Media. Greene County lawmakers toured the site of the new county jail June 10th. County Legislature Chairman Patrick Linger of New Baltimore said, and I quote, it's going fairly well. There were some hiccups with the supply chain, things coming from the other states, but we were able to work around that, end quote. Linger said 80 to 85 workers are present on the site every day. He said the shell of the building is complete while pointing out that the workforce has remained healthy. Linger said a task force of correction officers regularly checks the building for security issues. The 64-bed facility is expected to be completed in July 2021. The jail project is funded by a $39 million bond from Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated, and an $8.1 million contribution from the county. Catskill Representative Michael Hewlett agreed that construction was going well, but was dismayed to see the size of the facility firsthand. He said, and I quote, "Was this really all necessary?" End quote. Legislator Matthew Lavera, another Catskill representative, shared his colleague's opinion, but noted the project has stayed within the budget. The Public Safety Committee had previously approved a series of project changes at its June 8th meeting. The first change was a reduction of more than $185,601 to be paid to Gerson Construction Group for the engineering of the garage, cell fit-out reduction, chiller steel, and shoring system freight. Other changes approved included an expansion of services to James H. Malloy Incorporated of Londonville in the amounts of $3,000 for ground thawing, $7,200 for the Central Hudson Access Road, and $6,800 for crane stabilization plates, as well as to Infrastructure Technologies of Clifton Park in the amounts of $12,000 for additional security cameras and $7,500 for cell lighting control. None of the changes resulted in a change to the overall budget project. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Lauren Stanforth is reporting for the Times Union. Prince Alair County Executive Stephen McLaughlin said June 10th that the county is approving permits for public pools based on pre-pandemic guidelines for opening public pools, including pools at campgrounds and private clubs. McLaughlin pointed to the dearth of guidance provided by the state on the subject. Under the pre-pandemic requirements, approval of permits was based on criteria such as water testing and lifeguard certification. At Governor Andrew Cuomo's daily news briefing, aide Melissa DeRosa said the state guidance for municipal pools should be out in the coming days. At the same time, some Capital Region municipal pools had already announced they are not opening for the summer, including in Colony and Bethlehem. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has said there is no proof coronavirus can spread in recreational water. And you can read the full story in the Times Union. Nora Mishanek is reporting for Columbia Green Media. 31 employees of Columbia County have been approved to take 1 to 2 months off this summer as part of the county administration's voluntary full furlough program. The program is estimated to save the county $81,000. Employees approved for voluntary summer furloughs are exempt from the county's mandatory 13-day furlough initiative, which went into effect this week and is projected to save the county $1.5 million. Columbia County Board of Supervisors Chairman Matt Murrell said the county was prudent to act early to reduce expenses. He said, and I quote, "If we waited until August or September to implement strategies, we would have limited our options and we would have been faced with layoffs," end quote. County officials worked with the United Public Service Employees Union, which represents about 550 county workers, to negotiate the terms of the furloughs. Corrections officers, who are represented by the State Law Enforcement Officers Union, AFSCME, Council 82, are also part of the county's plan to reduce costs. Beginning in June, corrections officers are subject to a 6-day furlough. More than 40 correction officers and command staff at the Columbia County Jail, including Captain Brian Gardner, will have a mandatory day off with no pay, 1 day out of every month until November. The measure is expected to save the county $65,000. In addition to furloughs, county officials also implemented a hiring freeze on non-essential positions, reduced spending, and halted infrastructure projects, which Morrell called, and I quote, "planning for the worst-case scenario," end quote. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Wendy Schmaltz of Claverick, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You have tuned into the River Newsroom's Hudson Valley Coronavirus Report from Lissa Harris of The River and Roger Hennigan-Gilson of The Other Hudson Valley. Go to theotherhudsonvalley.com or therivernewsroom.com for more information and links to the stories included here. This report is a collaboration with several Hudson Valley journalists, airing on WGXC 90.7 FM at midnight, 5, 7, and 9 a.m., and online in the audio archives at WGXC.org. La Voz, a Spanish-language news magazine covering the Hudson Valley, is translating these roundups and co-publishing them on its website in Spanish at lavoz.bard.edu.
Lissa Harris has this report first. Are protests fueling the pandemic? It's an urgent question, and after two solid weeks of nationwide demonstrations in places both large and small, we still don't know. If protests are a major risk factor for spreading COVID-19, New York City is likely to feel the impact. Large protests in the city were underway by Thursday, May 28th, drawing thousands of people into the streets over the past 2 weeks. Although the daily number of new cases in the city has plummeted to a tiny fraction of its early April peak, New York City still has community transmission. On June 9th, the City Department of Health reported 110 new cases, down from 6,374 on April 6th. Governor Andrew Cuomo has made testing available to anyone who participated in recent protests, and health experts are encouraging participants to get tested and do 2 weeks of voluntary quarantine. So far, there's no sign of an uptick in protest-related cases in New York City, although it may be too soon to know for sure. It can take up to 14 days after exposure for symptoms to appear, although the median is closer to 4 or 5 days. Even after symptoms appear, people may wait until they're desperately ill to seek testing or treatment. Then there's the wait for test results, which might be a day, a week, or even longer. The horror of coronavirus data lag, as Atlantic put it, means that it takes weeks, perhaps even a month or more, to know the impact of an event or a policy change. By then, it has already taken its toll. Some experts say the early data on case counts in places with large protests is encouraging. Epidemiologist George Rutherford told the San Francisco Chronicle that if protests had caused outbreaks, he would have expected to see upticks in Minnesota by now. Quote, "Minnesota is falling steadily. There's one slight uptick on June 1st, but that may be because of a weekend reporting lag," unquote, he said. Quote, "But it's all trending down. If you look back 7 to 10 days, you would expect to be seeing a significant jump by now," unquote. Other experts are braced for a spike they feel is inevitable. For epidemiologists who deal regularly in the science of suffering, the protests present an opportunity to learn more about the virus. Jeremy Kondidjak, a senior policy fellow with the Center for Global Development and a member of the team that helped chart the Obama administration's Ebola response, noted in a Twitter thread that the protests represent a mix of factors already known to boost coronavirus spread: large crowds, people yelling loudly, and those known to help lessen risk: outdoors, widespread mask wearing, people moving around and not prolonging contact with any one person. Tear gas and pepper spray, which police have deployed broadly, increase the risk of transmission by causing people to cough and take off contaminated masks. Large-scale arrests may have created opportunities for super spreading. More than 2,000 protesters have been arrested in New York City, and many were detained overnight in close quarters without masks or hand sanitizer. Back in April, a month before George Floyd's death, Georgetown law professor and former reserve police officer Rosa Brooks wrote in a Washington Post op-ed that considering the pandemic, police should consider getting less physical. Quote, "Except in cases involving serious violent crimes, police officers nationwide need to go hands-off," unquote, she wrote. Police response to protests in large cities has mostly been anything but that. Scientific knowledge about which behaviors are most risky in the pandemic is evolving, but a few recent data points from Missouri point to a reason for optimism about the risk of protests. So far, public health officials say there have been no additional cases traced to large pool parties at Lake of the Ozarks over Memorial Day weekend, despite the fact that an infected person attended. In another highly publicized situation, two COVID-19 positive hairdressers in Springfield who wore masks and worked with 140 people while they were unknowingly infected did not pass the virus to any of their clients. These are just a few incidents, but they suggest a potential positive impact of taking measures to reduce risk, like holding gatherings outdoors and wearing masks. A recent British study also gave a boost to the value of mask wearing. Researchers from Cambridge and Greenwich modeled different population-wide scenarios using data from known person-to-person transmission chains and concluded that if more than half the population wore masks habitually, the R-naught for COVID-19 would drop below 1, causing the pandemic to shrink rather than grow. With outdoor events looking less risky and mask wearing more protective than scientists thought in the early days of the pandemic, there's reason to hope that recent massive protests haven't already sparked massive outbreaks. But even if that's true, there may be another sobering bit of collateral damage in the collision between pandemic and policing: public trust. Police work and the contact tracing done by public health departments are separate efforts, but in the age of surveillance, people may fear they are working hand in glove, and public officials aren't necessarily helping. Minneapolis Public Safety Commissioner John Harrington used the phrase contact tracing in a press conference to describe police intelligence gathering, a move that may have hurt local health efforts, Business Insider writes. There's also a worry that by telling people to stay home and then not denouncing the protests, epidemiologists and public health experts have eroded their credibility with the public. It's a nuanced topic, and debates among high-level experts are raging on Twitter about how they should be communicating with the public about it. For black people in public health, the dilemma of how to respond is especially personal. Charlottesville doctor Tayson Bell, who specializes in infectious disease and critical care, told The New Yorker that he's felt torn about whether to participate in protests. Quote, "I'm a black man and a physician. I can't choose one identity over the other, nor do I want to. Two competing factors, racism and COVID, are killing my community. It feels really unfair that I can't fight both at the same time," unquote. At least one epidemiologist has weighed in with some very preliminary back-of-the-envelope math, estimating the number of COVID-19 deaths that the protests will cause in the U.S. is between 50 and 500. A disproportionate number of them will be black, Trevor Bedford of the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center predicted. By comparison, police fatally shoot about 1,000 people a year in the United States. There's no way to know if those numbers will be borne out, but if any place in the nation is likely to yield data in the coming weeks on how protests have affected transmission, it might be New York. Now, in New York State, on Wednesday, June 10th, the daily COVID briefing by Governor Cuomo was one of the briefest of so far, just under 8 minutes, and did not include the daily death toll, 56, a hair up from daily deaths in New York State over the past week, which have been below 50 since June 4th. New positives are still trending downward, with 674 new cases in the state. 14 states and Puerto Rico are now seeing higher numbers of new COVID-19 cases than at any point in the pandemic so far, the Washington Post reports. Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, California, Florida, Kentucky, New Mexico, North Carolina, Mississippi, Oregon, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and Utah. Cuomo made the spiking states a cautionary tale in his June 10th briefing. Quote, "If you look at the states and the countries that have been reopening, more of them have gotten into trouble than not. As we sit here today, states are getting into trouble. Newspapers will tell you more than a dozen states are now seeing increases," unquote, he said. Quote, "Reopen, reopen, reopen. Be careful, be careful, be careful," unquote, he said. Cuomo and the New York State Department of Health have once again reversed course on a nursing home policy. On May 18th, Cuomo announced that all nursing home staff must be tested for COVID-19 twice a week. On June 10th, the state eased up on that requirement, saying the staff must be tested once a week. The New York Post, which has been doing some vigorous and pointy reporting on Cuomo's handling of nursing home outbreaks, took credit for the policy change. On June 8th, the Post reporter Bernadette Hogan got a scoop on a story about weeks-long delay for nursing homes getting their test results back. Announced by New York State on June 9th and June 10th, there are a couple of new COVID-19 dashboards on New York State's website, one that shows the percent of each county's daily test results coming back positive, and one that graphs current and historical data on the percent of tests coming back positive for the state and each of its 10 economic development regions. According to Wednesday's June 10th daily testing data, the North Country region had no positive test results in the past 24 hours, the only one of the state's 10 regions to hit zero, although Central New York and the Southern Tier were in the single digits. Now for the region-by-region report. Starting in the lower Hudson Valley, during an appearance on Westchester County Executive George Latimer's COVID-19 briefing, Metro North Railroad President Catherine Rinaldi reported that ridership jumped on June 8th when New York City reopened to 20,140, about 4% higher than it was during the middle of the pandemic. LowHUD.com also reports that the Metro North added 19 trains to its schedule on June 8th, and it will add another 48 to the morning and afternoon rush hours by next week. The bump will get the railroad to 61% of its normal weekday service. Number of hospitalized COVID-19 patients increased from 16 to 22 in Rockland County in the last 24 hours. Still a far cry from the numbers seen in late April, when hospitals held more than 200 patients in any given day. Maintaining a low rate of new hospitalizations is one of the metrics required to continue the phased reopening, but the increase was not expected to jeopardize the region's trajectory, according to LowHUD. In the mid-Hudson Valley, emergency room admissions are down 40% at Columbia Memorial Hospital in Hudson, and the number of people seeing specialists there has also dropped, even though elective surgeries are once again permitted. CMH officials said the hospital was not in danger of closing. The hospital furloughed 125 staffers in mid-April due to the slowdown, which has mostly been attributed to people being fearful of hospitals during the pandemic, though the cancellation of elective surgeries in the state also contributed. Dutchess County Executive Mark Molinaro provided an update on the projected revenue losses in the county in his COVID-19 town hall on Facebook Live June 10th. The county expects to lose between $40 and $80 million, about half of which derives from sales tax losses, which generally account for 41% of the county's revenue. Molinaro noted that the three monthly sales tax payments Dutchess County has received from the state since March 1st have been lower than 2019. Two announcements from Ulster County Executive Pat Ryan. On June 9th, Ryan outlined his outdoor dining initiative, which opens up county parking lots for seating and encourages municipalities to suspend local ordinances and zoning laws to allow for more physically distant outdoor dining pursuant to the rules outlined in Phase 2 of reopening. And on June 10th, Ryan formally announced the formation of a housing advisory committee to address the causes and drivers of Ulster's affordable housing shortage and recommend strategies that the county can pursue to alleviate it in conjunction with municipal business and community partners. 31 Columbia County employees agreed to be furloughed for either 1 or 2 months this summer to help close the pandemic-sized hole in the county budget. The plan is expected to save the county $81,000. This is distinct from mandatory furloughs negotiated between the county and the United Public Service Employees Union, wherein most county employees will not work or not be paid for 1 day out of every two-week pay period until December, a plan expected to save the county $1.5 million. In the Catskills, Sullivan County is no longer the second most unhealthy county in the state. According to a county press release, it now ranks as the third most unhealthy. Though the improvement in ranking, as calculated by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, was released to the county in March, officials decided not to release the news in the face of an overwhelming health crisis. Quote, "The timing would have been awkward and the message would have conflicted at a time when so many people were becoming ill, so we chose to wait until now to share this very welcome news," unquote, according to County Health Director Nancy McGraw. The latest victim in the pandemic in Schoharie County, Cobleskill Richmondville Central Schools Child Care Center, which suffered a total loss of revenue when schools closed down March 13th. District board members voted to approve shutting the center down last week, the Times Journal reports. The Roxbury, a Wonka-esque temple of luxury whimsy built on the bones of a Catskill strip motel, got dealt a rotten hand by the pandemic. Owners Gregory Henderson and Joseph Massa opened their second boutique hotel, a multi-million dollar gut renovation of a nearby mansion dubbed Stratton Falls, in February, and promptly lost all their customers in one fell swoop. Quote, "The virus has devastated our business," unquote, Henderson told Condé Nast Traveler in April. But they're back. On June 10th, the Roxbury owners announced the reopening of both hotels with a list of safety precautions that includes contactless check-in, handheld UV disinfection gadgets for staffers, and cooling-off periods for rooms after every occupancy. This has been the coronavirus report for Thursday, June 11th, from the Other Hudson Valley and the River Newsroom. Go to theRiverNewsroom.com or theOtherHudsonValley.com for more information about any of these stories.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
So we're talking with Bob Ganji, who is Executive Director of the Police Reform Organizing Project. I had first met Bob when he was, I guess, for almost three decades the executive director of the Correctional Association of New York State, which investigates prisons around the state. So Bob, why don't you give us just a brief introduction? What exactly is the Police Reform Organizing Project?
It's based in New York City. It's a tax-exempt nonprofit organization, engages in research, public education, aggressive policy advocacy aimed at exposing and ending abusive and discriminatory policing in New York City. We particularly target, up until this past 2 weeks when all hell is broken loose following the murder by police officers in Minneapolis of George Floyd, we target the day-to-day abusive and discriminatory practices in New York City by the police, and that's a focus on quota-driven broken windows policing. The short explanation of broken windows policing is, as it's applied in New York City, is it targets low-income people of color in different poor inner-city communities in the city who engage in minor infractions that have been virtually decriminalized in white areas. So there's an extraordinary and stark racial bias in the day-to-day practices of the NYPD, which our view is feeds the likelihood that the NYPD in certain situations will engage in egregious acts of violence and brutality. And we've seen that misconduct repeatedly in the videos of the police response to the protesters in New York City.
Now, one of the major calls that have emerged from these protests is the issue of defunding the police. And I know that Prop and others in New York City are pushing to try to cut $1 billion out of the, I guess, $6 billion or so budget for the New York Police Department, which actually city budget gets voted on, I believe, in the month of June. So can you talk a little bit about the whole concept of defund the police and what you're also particularly trying to get in New York City?
Right. The defund the police hashtag and rallying cry has gathered force all over the country, somewhat to my surprise from a political standpoint, and not that long ago in terms of what Prop and others were proposing for the NYPD budget was to cut it by $1 billion over the next 4 or 5 years. And then there was a breakthrough politically. It really came from and I don't know, Mark, if you're aware of this, you might be if you're following what's going on in New York City, a large number of people who either still work for the de Blasio administration or formerly work for the de Blasio administration signed the letter, released it publicly. It's now over 400 people who've signed on to that letter. It was a scathing criticism of de Blasio's handling of NYPD issues and NYPD abusive practices. And that letter called for a $1 billion cut next year, in 1 year. And that broke things open in terms of what we at Prop and other advocacy organizations felt they could credibly put on the table. So now we're proposing, along with other organizations, as I said, a $1 billion cut to defund the NYPD. And the significance of it is, it's our analysis that the kind of reforms that politicians often get behind regarding police reform, like what the state passed, I think just yesterday, was banning chokeholds and repealing what's known as 50A, a law that supposedly prohibits the NYPD from releasing the disciplinary records of cops. And Cuomo and other people, the press, including some of the police reformers, are touting these legislative acts as huge victories. Our view very much is these are not huge victories. These are tweaking around the edges. These are the kind of things that other cities across the country already have in place, Minneapolis being a prime example. Minneapolis has all these kind of modest reforms that were administered over the last 5 or 6 years coming out of a committee on policing issues that the Obama administration put together. And there's been no change on the ground in Minneapolis. Now the leadership of Minneapolis is calling for just
together. Being in complete unity with each other, harmony with each other, and not letting the man maneuver us into fighting one another. As long as we practice brotherhood among ourselves, and then others who want to practice brotherhood with us, we're for that. But I don't think that we should run around trying to love somebody who doesn't love us.
One thing I can tell you is you got to be free.
Get it? Take a look into the sky and see a scrape in the buildings. Or look into the mirror, see the face of resilience. My heart and frustration is in it. When I spit it, it's vintage. Soul molded into my own image. Yeah.
One thing I can tell you is you got to be free.
Hi, I'm Thomas from Athens. You're listening to WGHC 90.7 FM, ATRA.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects. Information is available at cdc.gov/COVID-19.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518- 622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Peter W. Bone of Gilboa, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for June the 11th, 2020. I'm Mike Clifford. The police killing of George Floyd has amplified calls for white communities to openly discuss systematic racism. Mike Bowen reports the calls include adults having talks with school-aged children.
Protesters demanding racial justice say providing kids with a better understanding of the history behind racial inequalities can help to eliminate such problems in the future. Mary McCorkle, president of the South Dakota Education Association, says she thinks both parents and teachers can play a role in sparking conversations. She says classrooms provide a good setting since many students are curious about the news they're exposed to.
Students are, again, depending upon their age, are very much aware of what's going on. Or if they're younger students, they may have questions.
McCorkle says it's important to let students lead the conversations and for teachers and parents to follow up with questions. She says the situation also creates opportunities for school districts to enhance their curriculum to have a more accurate portrayal of the nation's history when it comes to systemic racism. McCorkle hopes the awareness also will lead to the hiring of more educators of color, which she says can help students from diverse backgrounds feel more connected in the classroom.
How do we begin to help grow the number of educators of color so that students, they see themselves reflected in the world around them?
According to federal data, South Dakota is among 30 states that have a shortage of bilingual teachers. Advocates say this issue is a top priority as a way to help shape a more robust learning environment in classrooms across the state. Meantime, the pause for eviction granted to Nevadans who haven't been able to pay their rent during COVID-19 has been extended through at least June 30th, but many don't know how they'll make good on what they owe if they don't have their jobs back.
Nevada has the nation's highest unemployment rate due to the pandemic at 28%, with Las Vegas especially hard hit. Norma Quinones was laid off from her job as a food server on March 15th after 20 years with the Aria Resort and Casino. She says she's lived in her current apartment for 7 years.
I'm paying my bills, but I'm like a month behind on my money, so I'm worried about it and scared. And to move is not cheap, expensive.
In Nevada, the governor's moratorium froze eviction and foreclosure proceedings involving residential or commercial properties. It also blocks late fees or penalties for non-payment during the pandemic, but does not exempt residents from eventually making up the payments. Quinones received the $1,200 federal stimulus check and some unemployment funds, but because she works for tips, says it doesn't equal what she earns as a restaurant server on the Las Vegas Strip. As a result, she's 2 months behind on rent and has received several calls from bill collectors. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
This is PNS. With the global pandemic and national racial unrest, these are unprecedented times for youth in Michigan. Sexual health advocates say they can't commit to their mission without taking a stand against police violence and racism.
As a program coordinator with the Michigan Organization on Adolescent Sexual Health, Natasha Thomas Jackson works to ensure young people have access to sexual health education and services. And she explains all of these issues are not mutually exclusive.
We dig deep enough to find at the root of all of this, of all of these things, whether it's COVID or police brutality or lack of reproductive justice, a lot of it is rooted in structural inequalities around race and around class that we have to grapple with.
Jackson says the reproductive justice movement was created by Black women who are excluded from the mainstream reproductive health movement, and contends that dismantling systems of oppression is the only way to shift conditions and achieve reproductive justice. Mary Sherman reporting.
Pennsylvania's ability to control some forms of air pollution may be at risk after the House Environmental Resources and Energy Committee there narrowly advanced a bill this week that opponents say would jeopardize efforts to reduce carbon emissions.
The official title of House Bill 2025 is the Pennsylvania Carbon Dioxide Cap and Trade Authorization Act. But according to Robert Ruth with the Clean Air Council, the goal of the bill that advanced on Tuesday is to block Governor Tom Wolf's effort to have the state join the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGGI, a successful multi-state agreement that uses carbon cap and trade to reduce carbon emissions.
It would not just prevent that action from going forward, but it would strip DEP of its existing statutory authority to take any action to limit carbon dioxide emissions.
Sponsors of the bill say that as a major exporter of electric power and the third largest coal-producing state, Pennsylvania's economy would be harmed by limiting carbon emissions. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
Finally, our Eric Tegenoff tells us Congress could give a boost to the outdoor places folks like in states like Montana. He adds they are places they enjoy the most.
The Senate is considering the Great American Outdoors Act, which would cut maintenance costs for national parks by $6 billion over 5 years and permanently fund the Land and Water Conservation Fund. The LWCF is used to open access to public lands, as well as for projects such as city parks and hiking trails. Dan Vermillion owns Sweetwater Travel Company and is a former Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Commissioner.
Whether you're a soccer player, a baseball player, fisherman or a hunter, or a boater or a hiker, the LWCF has provided immeasurable benefits to our state and our recreational pursuits and our recreational economy.
A full vote on the bill could come this week.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. I'm Philip Grant. Rick Carlin is reporting for the Times Union. State lawmakers this week unanimously approved a measure that, if signed into law by Governor Andrew M. Cuomo, would ban the incineration of PFAS-filled firefighting foam in the city of Cohoes. Explaining how the measure made it through the legislature during a session dominated by debate over police reforms, bill co-sponsor Assemblymember John McDonald of Cohoes said, and I quote, "We wanted to strike while the iron was hot," end quote. The ban was co-sponsored by Senator Neil Breslin of Delmar. McDonnell and Breslin are both Democrats. The burning of the aqueous film-forming foam at the Norlite aggregate plant in Cohoes has become a major environmental issue in the capital region. In February, city officials learned that Norlite had been incinerating the unused foam collected from other locations. The company also has a contract with the U.S. Department of Defense to accept the foam for disposal. The city this spring passed an incineration moratorium. The city this spring passed an incineration moratorium, so Norlite is not currently burning the foam. The bill to ban incineration was limited to cities in New York with a population between 16,000 and 17,000, which includes Cohoes. The Cohoes facility is the only one statewide that currently incinerates AFFF. Read the full story in the Times Union. Adele Kaplan is reporting for NBCNews.com. A federal judge June 10 ruled that Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrests at courthouses in New York are illegal. The decision was rendered in a case filed by State Attorney General Letitia James and Brooklyn District Attorney Eric Gonzalez that sought to stop ICE from making civil immigration arrests at state courthouses. Local officials, including police chiefs and state prosecutors, have for years said that ICE operations inside courthouses have hampered their ability to investigate and prosecute crimes. James and Gonzalez argued that ICE's current courthouse arrest policy, based on a January 28 directive, exceeded its authority. Judge Jed Rakoff of the Southern District of New York wrote in the opinion, contrasting the arrests with the challenges COVID-19 has created for the court system. He wrote, and I quote, "The court declares ICE's policy of courthouse arrest to be illegal. It is one thing for the state courts to try to deal with the impediments brought on by a pandemic, and quite another for them to have to grapple with disruptions and intimidations artificially imposed by an agency of the federal government," end quote. Read the full story at NBCNews.com. Gary Stern reports in the Rockland Westchester Journal News that as school board and budget voting goes on this week through the mail, Governor Andrew Cuomo has finally said what districts can do if their budgets are voted down. An executive order issued June 10 says school districts can hold a second vote. Those second votes will not happen before July 9th. Assemblyperson Amy Paulin, a Democrat from Westchester County, had sponsored a bill that would allow a second vote. She thanked Cuomo for taking action to, and I quote, "provide some certainty to districts and enable them to avoid making the draconian cuts that would be required if they were forced to adopt a contingency budget," end quote. On June 7th, Cuomo signed an executive order allowing school election ballots to be counted if they are postmarked by June 16th. The original deadline for ballots to be received by school districts was June 9th. Read more about this story in the Rockland Westchester Journal News. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Thursday, June 11th. Yes, folks, we find ourselves in protest season already, and here I still have my COVID decorations up. That's only half a joke. Greene County is doing very well in that respect, and some of that can be blamed on us implementing safety procedures before it got here. We gotta keep it up, or else we risk losing the gains that we have fought so hard for, people, so keep those masks on in the stores, keep washing those hands, and if somebody isn't wearing a mask, then try to avoid them. Today, alright, getting to the weather, looks pretty uncomfortable. Starting out at 73 this morning with dew points in the upper 60s and lower 70s today, things will be sticky. Leftover rain from last night lingers until noon. Chances of thunder are present. Our high today of 84 occurs around 4 p.m. After 8 p.m., the air gets comfortable again. Temperatures lower to the upper 50s overnight. And so do the dew points, which will stay there, leaving Friday comfortable as the day gets warmer. It will be dry and warm with a high of 83. Saturday will be very nice with a tiny chance of rain, and Sunday will be moist. Pollen levels are low today, medium high tomorrow. The next high tides will be at 7:59 a.m. and at 8:43 p.m. The next low tides will be at 2:38 p.m. and tomorrow at 2:55 a.m. Water temperature will be 74 degrees today. Sunset will be at 8:11 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:18 a.m. Looking way up, we see the sun appears to be waking up. I say that tentatively, since this solar minimum has been pretty hard to crawl out of. Sunspots are becoming more active. Chances of radio communication enhancement are increasing steadily. Today, we can see sunspot 2765 crackling with B-class solar flares. Solar wind speed is currently 436 kilometers per second at 2.6 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3, quiet. The current sunspot number is 11. And this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Lávese las manos, evite a las personas enfermas y evite tocarse la cara. Hay acciones cotidianas para ayudar a prevenir la propagación de enfermedades respiratorias. Visite cdc.gov/COVID-19. Gentileza de la National Association of Broadcasters y de esta estación.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the Rodney Shop in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
If you're going to put your corporate logo behind Black Lives Matter, then you better put your logo and your influence behind the idea that Black votes matter. Every election cycle, for years, as you've heard before, we see the tactics which suppress our votes.
Wendy Fields leads Democracy Initiative, a coalition of small-D Democratic reform groups. Fields, who is Black, says people are fed up with the long lines, malfunctioning machines, lost absentee ballots, and other voting problems that make it harder for every citizen to vote, and especially Black and Indigenous people of color, people experiencing homelessness, and people with disabilities. Georgia was the latest to demonstrate these forms of voter suppression, but Fields says Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Wisconsin showed the same pattern.
We're fed up for not being counted. We're fed up for not being heard. We're fed up with our lives being threatened. The knee of racism is going to be on our neck again in November if people are turned away at the polls, if all the ballots aren't counted.
George Floyd's brother, Philonis Floyd, testified before Congress yesterday, encouraging lawmakers to pass police reforms now. Hours later, former Vice President Joe Biden joined the NAACP for a virtual town hall.
We know there's been institutional racism in this country before we were a country. It didn't start with Donald Trump. It's not going to end with Donald Trump. But right now, we have an enormous opportunity to make significant change.
Recent polling from Civics shows support for Black Lives Matter up 10 points in the last 2 weeks. That's more change than in the last 2 years. While Republican lawmakers refrain from criticizing House Democrats' police reform bill, the Justice and Policing Act, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell tasked the Senate's only Black Republican, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, with drafting a GOP version.
If they want to try, I want to listen, because they are going to have to do something.
Democratic Ohio Representative Marsha Fudge hopes the Senate's bill will also ban chokeholds and no-knock forced entries in drug cases, increase accountability, and condition funding on anti-discrimination policies, among other measures.
Let me just say this, Ed. We have them on the run. quite frankly. Right now, the president has Tim Scott trying to come up with a bill. And so they know they must do something.
After polling that shows Biden in a better position to beat an incumbent than any challenger since Bill Clinton in 1992, Trump announced his first big rallies since the new coronavirus lockdown, next week in Tulsa, Oklahoma, then Arizona, North Carolina, and Florida. He also became the first president to threaten to sue CNN for one of its standard polls. The outlet stands by the survey and says they've never before been threatened by a political campaign over polling results. And despite reports that the Republican National Convention would be moving to Jacksonville, Florida, the RNC voted last night to pare down and keep it in Charlotte, North Carolina. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Hola. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I am Eileen Javier. I am here with Cleana Lightborn. She's a statewide civil rights organizer for Citizen Action of New York. She's working to end mass criminalization and incarceration of Black and Brown people. Cleana has led numerous workshops to help and heal poor communities that are continuously damaged by unjust and racist laws. Hi, Cleana. Welcome back to the sanctuary. You have been busy.
Yes, I have. Thank you so much for having me.
The 2020 Democratic Albany County District Attorney primary election is coming up on June 23rd. The district attorney candidates, the incumbent David Soros and Matt Toporowski, his challenger, debated virtually on Thursday, June 4th. We want to hear your thoughts about these two candidates. But before that, why is it important that the community pays attention to what these two candidates are telling us? Can you briefly tell us what are the responsibilities of the district attorney?
Sure, absolutely. So the responsibility of the district attorney, it really is to set the pace and the path of each case that is tried by their county. So we have Albany County DA, David Soares. So David is in charge of everything from what charges a person will be facing, whether or not they'll be allowed to have a plea deal, what their plea deal will be. They get to suggest what the bail amounts will be. Pretty much everything related to an individual's case, the DA has say in how it's run. And that's why I think it's really important for folks to understand that it's not just the mayoral races we have to look for. It's not just the presidential races, but something as really pivotal as a DA race is also something we need to pay attention to. We have the opportunity of continuing with a DA who has shown his interest in punitive ways to deal with the community, you know, being hard on tough and focused prosecutions of violent offenders and providing other outlets for folks who, you know, may not look, I would say, like the average offender or what we think of, yes, when we hear the word criminal. DA Soares is capable of doing things that are community-minded. But he has shown in the time that he has been in office for about 20 years that he is not community minded and doesn't seem like he'll be making that change anytime soon. One thing that's really exciting about Matt Toporowski is that he used to work with DA Soares. And so he's seen the way that systems work. He was so unhappy with it. He decided to do his own work and then eventually build so he could become a candidate for DA. Matthew, I'm sorry. It really is community-minded. He has open conversations with people in the community from all walks of life and from all areas. Matt goes from Arbor Hill to Bethlehem to have conversations with people about the meaningful ways in which we can work together to make a safe community without pushing people into the margins and throwing people away, essentially.
The focus of their campaign is very different. David Soares has focus his campaign on protecting communities, smart reform. Basically, he says reducing street violence, building hope for the people of Albany County, advocating for the sealing of past nonviolent criminal convictions, and emphasizing prevention over prosecution through his Clean Slate Initiative and Making Crime Pay program. Matt Toporowski has focused his campaign on fair justice for all. Seek solutions, no convictions. Create a fair and equitable justice system and compassionate prosecution and second chances. So based on the focus of their campaign, what should the community be paying attention about these two very different platforms? What can you say about that?
I think it's really important to look at how each DA candidate is addressing the community. Are they pushing forward this idea of like us versus them, you know, us the community versus them the criminals? Or are the DAs taking a holistic approach and saying that every arrest is a failed policy in our community, is a failed system of support in our community? Do we have DAs that will show mercy and show grace and show humanity? Or are we looking at a DA that is looking for a high arrest record or looking to put away people who they deem dangerous without allowing them an opportunity for restitution, an opportunity for, you know, fixing the harm that they caused in our communities? These are not strangers. These are not monsters. These are people who are in difficult situations in their life who need help. And we need a DA that understands that preventative measures and that community, like strengthening our communities, is just as important as holding people accountable when they cause harm.
What other key races Citizen Action is focusing on?
Sure. Well, Citizen Action is a statewide organization. So we have endorsements all over New York State. Another key endorsement that we have here in Albany is Sam Fine. Sam Fine is currently running for assembly member, I believe, in the 115th district. That's against John McDonald. And so that's also a really great race to follow as well, as our elected legislation also makes incredible changes in our community through the legislation that they pass or choose not to pass.
And for the people who are listening and they're so discouraged with the current system that they do not even believe in voting, can you say something to them?
Absolutely. Oh, and I did want to go back. It's the 108th district.
Okay. My apologies. No, thank you.
Yeah, but I did want to say that it really seems like, I know that everything feels really difficult and it's a really scary time for all of us right now. I think that you can do more than just march in the streets. This is your time to tap into what's going on in your community. Look at what your legislators, your elected officials, your local businesses, and your local DAs are saying around police reforms, around public safety, and around what it means to be a safe community. It's a good time to not only march in the streets, but also educate yourself and find out about the local elections that are coming up. Presidential elections, of course, are extremely important, but you find that things change more quickly based on the changes that happen in local elections. So I absolutely encourage folks to really look for local organizations like here in Albany. Feel free to check out Citizen Action of New York. We have a bunch of different ways to be involved and to learn more about what's going on in our area. We have workshops almost every week, if not every day, it feels like. So I would definitely say, you know, continue to take care of yourself, be easy on yourself, and just, it's time to plug in.
And what else would you like to say to our listeners?
Well, I would like to thank them for tuning into WOOC, which is one of the best stations in the area to really get well-documented, well-researched and unbiased reporting. So keep up the great work and be sure to support WOOC. Be sure to support all public and not-for-profit broadcasting. That's the way that we keep ourselves most informed. And yeah, and thank you again for having me.
When is your next workshop? Can you tell the audience when is it so they can sign up for it?
Absolutely. Our next workshop, I will actually be the one running it. We're going to be having a debrief on the pre-trial rollbacks that happened this year. Yeah, last year we experienced a bunch of really incredible reforms. And then this year, in the middle of a pandemic, Governor Cuomo, Andrea Stewart Cousins and Carl Heastie all got together and with their assembly in the Senate decided to roll back some of the reforms that we had passed just the year before. So we'll be discussing that. We'll be discussing what it means once it's implemented July 2nd. And we'll talk about the ways in which it ties in with the mass health crisis that we are having in prisons. So that event is happening on June 9th. That's Tuesday at 6 p.m. And you can go to citizenactionny.org to find more information or find Citizen Action on Facebook for more information.